This is Pittsburgh Explainer, a new podcast from 90.5 WESA. Every Friday, our reporters are here to help you understand some of the biggest news stories from southwestern Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed.
I'm Reed Frazier. I cover energy and environment for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania.
I'm Sarah Bowden. I cover health and science.
I'm Margaret J. Krause. I cover development and transportation.
It's Friday, February 28th. Today, the U.S. Attorney's Office in western Pennsylvania is investigating a 2018 natural gas pipeline explosion in Beaver County. Enrollment continues to decline for a state supplemental nutrition program in Allegheny County, and PennDOT faces a funding cliff. We'll dig into these stories right after the break.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. I'm coming to Pittsburgh to give a talk that I call Seven Things I've Learned, which is basically just an excuse to tell a bunch of stories and play clips and play video and talk about how we make our radio show, talk about stuff we have not put on the air and never will put on the air, and talk about things I've seen as a reporter that has stuck with me. It's Saturday, March 21st at the Byam Theater. Tickets at trustarts.org/humanities. Again, trustarts.org/humanities.
And we're back. Reed, you've been covering the news that federal officials are investigating the explosion of a natural gas pipeline owned by the company Energy Transfer. Now, this is a pipeline that sends gas from wells to processing plants, and when it exploded in 2018, it destroyed one home and forced the evacuation of an entire neighborhood. What do we know about this investigation so far?
Well, we know there was a subpoena from the Western District of Pennsylvania U.S. attorney to the company for documents related to the explosion, and that this subpoena was for a federal grand jury. And what that means is that this is a criminal probe.
Do we know what potential crimes they could have committed?
We don't. I mean, there's a slew of environmental laws that carry some aspect of criminal procedure, that there could be criminal charges against a company for violating them. But we just don't know.
In January, the State Department of Environmental Protection issued actually its largest ever fine in relation to the explosion. That was $30.6 million. And at that time, a DEP spokesperson referred to, quote, unlawful conduct. What kind of conduct are we talking about?
Well, there were literally thousands of infractions of construction standards along the course of this pipeline, resulting in things like multiple landslides. They unlawfully diverted or eliminated portions of streams that they weren't supposed to. And just one detail that sort of stands out about this case in particular, this pipeline, is this company, it came out in that fine, the company had identified this spot as like a high likelihood area of sort of a high danger area for landslides. That was like in 2016. And then earlier in the year, while they were building this pipeline, there was a landslide at basically the exact same spot a few months before the explosion. As the company was putting the hillside back together, restoring it, the DEP noted in their settlement agreement that the company didn't refer to engineers or geotechnical experts while they were putting it back together. And then a week after they start running gas through the line, there's a huge rainstorm in Beaver County and the hillside gives way and the pipeline explodes. The level of fine is so much greater than what the DEP typically gives out. That sort of shows how serious the DEP views the situation.
What's the second highest fine?
Yeah, so this was like a $30 million fine, and the second highest was like $12 million, which the same company got last year for other infractions on the Mariner East pipeline. This is the big pipeline going from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia. And especially in Philadelphia, they've had a lot of problems with spills and construction problems. There are a couple of investigations from district attorneys in the eastern part of the state, as well as Attorney General Josh Shapiro is investigating the Mariner East. And the FBI is actually investigating the state of Pennsylvania for permitting the Mariner East to begin with a few years ago. So they have some really high-profile criminal investigations into their pipelines in the state.
This is Margaret. One of the things I hear in terms of the water and sewer regulation world is that DEP is just strapped for resources in terms of oversight capacity. Do you think this is one of those times where there just aren't enough people in DEP to keep an eye on everything that's going on?
You could certainly make that argument. the big issue with this pipeline was something called like erosion and sedimentation, which is basically like when you're putting a pipeline or a road together on a hillside, you got to be really careful about how you put that pipeline in. The agency that was in charge of overseeing this pipeline's erosion controls was something called a conservation district, the Beaver County Conservation District. And a few months after this happened, the DEP withdrew that agency's authority to oversee this because they said that they weren't doing a good enough job. Probably a little too late on that. But, you know, you could definitely see this as a breakdown in regulation, too. Like, you could say, well, if this was a high likelihood that there would be a landslide there, shouldn't the DEP have, you know, sent somebody there? But there are a lot of pipelines going in Pennsylvania, and the DEP's staffing levels are static. They aren't just adding a ton more inspectors.
What did the company say about this latest investigation?
They're not saying much. I tried to reach out to them Wednesday, and they said that basically all of the pertinent information was included in the federal financial filings that disclosed this grand jury investigation. They acknowledge that it exists to their investors because they have to under SEC, Security and Exchange Commission's law. So that's how this information got out in the first place.
Sarah, you've been looking into why local enrollment in the state's Women, Infant, and Children program, or WIC, continues to decline. That's despite recent efforts to make it more user-friendly by replacing paper checks with EBT cards, which basically function like debit cards. So how big of a decline are we talking about?
We're talking about a roughly 6% decline here in the county since the change happened from checks to EBT cards in July. Statewide, though, numbers are actually up. It's nearly what it was 2 years ago. So something's going on in Allegheny County. We don't really know what, though. My best guess is that two offices in Allegheny County, two of the eight WIC offices or WIC locations, temporarily closed back in October, and then both have now reopened. But when you have to go to a WIC appointment four times a year, that's kind of a big deal.
So people actually have to go in person to these WIC offices to remain in the program?
Yes, and it can be a really huge inconvenience because these offices generally are only open during office hours and you have to bring your kid to most appointments. And so if women are taking the bus to an appointment and they have to take off work, and I'm told that sometimes wait times for an appointment can be pretty unpredictable. So sometimes you're there for 15 minutes, sometimes you're there for an hour and a half. It's a pretty big barrier to the program for some people.
Why do they require these in-person visits?
Well, it's a nutrition program. So you meet with a nutritionist and they look at your child and see that they're growing and that they're healthy. And sometimes they'll take iron level tests, a hemoglobin test.
This is Reed. What's the difference between WIC and food stamps?
That's a great question. So WIC is specifically geared towards families. It's called Women, Infant, and Children, but you don't have to be a mother to get a WIC benefit. It's way more limited in what you can buy with a WIC benefit, where SNAP, or Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, it's also for low-income families. But it doesn't stop at once the kid turns age 5.
Like, you don't even have to have kids to get SNAP,
right? That's true. And then there aren't as many, far fewer limitations on what you can buy with this assistance.
What kind of limits are there and what types of food people can buy?
Only certain types of breads, only certain types of cereals. You only get something like $11 for the parents and maybe like $8 or $9 per kid per month for fresh fruits and vegetables. You can't buy organic milk. You can't buy organic cheese. You can't buy cube cheese. You can't buy deli cheese. You can't buy imported cheese. You can't buy fresh meats, only canned meats. You can buy a lot of juice. You can buy a lot of juice with WIC. I've been told by a woman who uses WIC that when she goes in and meets with the nutritionist, they'll say, stop giving your kid all this juice. Juice isn't healthy. It doesn't have a lot of fiber. There's a lot of sugar. And then she'll get her benefits reloaded and it'll be like $8 for fruits and vegetables and then a lot of juice, which her family doesn't go through. It's objectively, I can say as a reporter, the program could be vastly improved.
Did parents tell you that they had any problems like figuring out exactly what they can buy in the store?
Yeah, I talked to one woman named Janisha Bice. She had three kids who have all aged out of the WIC program, but she was using WIC for, I believe, all three of them. And she said that it can be really confusing to like figure out which brands you can buy with WIC. And then it can be a huge headache, as we'll hear in a second. When you're checking out, it can be a huge headache.
I'm not going to say it's humiliating. It just doesn't make you feel good. You know, you feel like you're inconveniencing others. the cashier, and then, you know, it just make your shopping trip longer because besides you looking for the specific products that you have to get throughout the store, then when you get to the register, you think you picked out all the correct things, and some things go through, some things don't. One day they will, one day they won't.
What she described is an experience that a lot of people have with WIC.
What did the Department of Health say in response to these criticisms?
Well, the Department of Health says it is looking at ways to make remote nutrition counseling or those quarterly appointments, maybe make them remote instead of in person. And then they said, like, a lot of states have seen a drop of enrollment when the change went from checks to EBT cards. And that is true. And nationwide, WIC enrollment is declining. So I'm really curious to know, and I think people are studying this right now, how much of it is, you know, the administrative burden of learning a new program, even though EBT cards are easier to use, versus just like the barriers to the program are so onerous that, you know, people just don't want to bother.
Margaret, this week you covered PennDOT's budget appropriations hearing in the State House of Representatives on Tuesday. What's the point of these hearings?
A couple of things. One is the secretary of the pertinent department sits at a rectangular table in front of the Appropriations Committee and takes whatever questions they have. So it's an opportunity for representatives from vastly different places to ask their specific questions directly to the secretary in charge of that money. It's also just a precursor to the sort of bare-knuckle budget season. So they're gathering information, they're figuring out what's really important, they're figuring out what wiggle room there is before they all have to get in a room and find a deal by June 30th.
Things are particularly precarious for this department. The Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission, which is totally separate from PennDOT, supports public transit agencies to the tune of $450 million, and that money goes through PennDOT. So what's going to happen to that funding stream in the next couple of years?
So the Turnpike Commission has been taking out a $450 million bond every year.
So the Turnpike Commission is going into debt to pay for public transit throughout the state.
Yes. And the head of the Turnpike Commission will tell you that they are the most over-leveraged body in Pennsylvania. And people are really peeved to see their tolls go up year after year after year. And no wonder people are mad about that because they feel like the cost of them is going up, but they're not really seeing the improvement in the roads and it goes to public transit. But that's a more nebulous benefit. It's not exactly a one-to-one. So what happens in a couple of years is that the payment drops from $450 million to $50 million. So suddenly there's a $400 million hole.
And it's not like PennDOT. I mean, no government agency has enough money as it is, right?
No, everyone would love more money to do the things that they're charged with doing. Would love more money.
So how big of a headache is this going to create for PennDOT?
It's a pretty big headache. We already, so Pennsylvania is huge, and it has a ton of interstate highways, a ton of rural roads, a ton of small roads, a ton of structurally deficient bridges, transportation to support. And then suddenly there's this gaping hole, and PennDOT is looking at new streams of revenue, looking at maybe congestion pricing where people who use a road at a peak travel hour, such as 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning, would pay a higher fee than someone using it at 2 p.m. But it's not going to make up a $400 million hole, so the legislature has to find that money somewhere in the general fund.
Long term, what does this mean for how PennDOT does business?
Most immediately, they're trying to make the work they do right now more resilient and more stable for the long term. So for instance, if they build a bridge, they're building it in such a way that it's more resistant to floods or more resistant to landslides because they only have so many dollars. They have to be really careful in how they spend them. And that's something that Acting Secretary Yasmin Gramian said kind of over and over.
We're actually trying to be smarter and better about the new projects that we are designing. That we're spending the money, we're creating a more resilient infrastructure.
Pennsylvania faces a raft of challenges moving forward in terms of climate change. We're not on a coast, but we have a lot of water. And as Reed mentioned earlier, we're prone to landslides. Since 2018, Pennsylvania has seen 120 landslides, which affects all these roads, some of which remain closed. And recouping that funding or even just finding the money to fix those is a further stress on the system. And so this idea of how do we invest now in projects we're doing to support change and uncertainty in the future is really crucial.
What other budget issues is PennDOT grappling with right now?
One of the big issues that came up in the hearing, especially from legislators from more rural counties, is that PennDOT has had to shift money from its more rural, smaller roads into its interstate highways, there's a federal mandate that requires investment in interstate highways. And so a bunch of legislators were concerned because growth in their districts isn't along highways, it's along smaller roads. A number of constituents rely on small roads to just get to work, get to school. And to watch that money go away is really hard because how do they turn to their people and say, sorry, you just won't be able to do those things?
It's time for a quick break, and when we get back, in other news.
If you're getting a new car, don't trade it, donate it. Rather than head to the dealer, donate that unwanted vehicle to WESA to support NPR in Pittsburgh. Your support is worth more than a low trade-in offer, and it keeps your favorite programming on the air. All of the details are at wesa.fm/cars.
It's time for our segment called In Other News, where we recommend a story or some other piece of media you should check out this week. Read what you got.
So there's this podcast called Reply All, which is about the internet and technology. But they have this really fascinating three-part series from about a month ago about this bizarre battle within the Alabama Democratic Party. It really gets into some of these characters and, you know, why Democrats in this very red state are fighting with each other.
People talk about right now that there's sort of some fissures going on in the Democratic Party, and it's sort of along two lines. You'll often hear this narrative, one between the progressive and the moderates, and then also between the old guard and the new guard.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, a little bit of an old guard versus new guard thing. But this being Alabama, it's also about civil rights and race. It really is sort of a study in people wanting to get interested in politics, but sort of meeting like all these structural barriers and like trying to confront their state's history, the country's history.
Margaret, what are you recommending this week?
There was a 2019 update to the Childcare in State Economies report. Childcare is a multi-billion dollar issue in terms of the U.S. economy, and it seems like no one can figure out how to make sure that parents can go to work and make sure that their children are happy and learning and getting snacks at regular intervals, maybe even naps.
And at the same time, childcare professionals make not a lot of money.
Not a lot of money. And one estimate in Pennsylvania is that childcare for two can cost up to $42,000. That's a state college per year education. There have been some proposals where maybe you could pull money from your 401k without a hit, but that means that you're destabilized as an older adult. It's a crucial issue for our society, and there are some very interesting just ideas in this report about what could happen and what needs to happen.
Sarah Bowden, what are you looking at this week?
So as everyone is aware, coronavirus is traveling around the globe, and you're seeing a lot of people with the face masks. And the CDC has released a very helpful chart to show what sorts of facial hair is.
You guys are all looking at
looking
me.
Looking to read.
Why are you looking at me?
Got a beard, sir.
You would have to shave that because your facial hair, especially on your cheeks and your chin, would prevent an adequate seal of a face mask.
You're saying my beard is unhygienic? Is that what's happening?
No, yes. I'm saying that it would prevent you from an adequate seal.
I don't have any hair on the top of my head, so like my beard is sort of like the last vestige. So I guess I'll do it for you guys.
Well, what I find particularly delightful about this chart is that there are so many different types of facial hair, like the French fork, the ducktail, chevron, painter's brush, chin curtain, lampshade. Basically, you'll be safe. The seal will be adequate if you have the facial hair of a French race car driver from like the 1920s, but otherwise you should probably shave your beard.
Isn't the advice that you don't need a face mask unless you actually have coronavirus or think you might? Like, if you're a healthy person, you shouldn't go out and stock up on face masks because then sick people won't have any face masks to wear.
That's accurate. So, like, let's all chill out on the hoarding.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Thanks to my guest, Reed Frazier.
Thank you, Liz.
Sarah Bowden.
Thanks.
And Margaret J. Krause.
Thanks, Liz.
Our show is produced and engineered by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. I'm your host, Liz Reed. You can find all of WESA's reporting on our website, wesa.fm, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. Thanks for listening. See you next week.